ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Elsie Adamo with you today, filling in for Selena Green, who's on the sick list. And thank you for finding us today. We're streaming online and on the ABC Listen app while the cricket is on, and it's starting soon. A big good luck to Australia. In a moment, do stick around because you'll hear about some Merino stud ram producers who have had better than expected sales in recent months. And survey results from MLA show confidence in the wool game is lifting.
In a very basic sense, just looking at the data, it shows that wool growers are now positive about wool growing. They're actually turned from being against wool growing and looking at other enterprises, now switching focus back on wool growing as a viable enterprise on farm.
Are you a wool producer? Have you been feeling more confident? Are you feeling more optimistic? Now we are, things are in parts, not everywhere, of course, starting to get a little bit wetter. Let me know. Our talkback number today, 1300 160 222, or text into the program 0467 922 783. And also, happy National Ag Day to everyone listening. Now, we do tend to celebrate Ag on the Country Hour every weekday, not just once a year. But still, is National Ag Day something you think about? Do you celebrate at all? What are you up to today? Again, my talkback number 1300 160 222 or the text line 0467 922 783. Now, first today, many Merino stud ram producers have been pleasantly surprised with recent results at on-property sales. South Australia's ram sales wrapped up last month with more than 70 sales held from July to October. Merino SA President Robert Sullivan told Brooke Neindorf that despite the season, there was still some reasonably good sales.
Yeah, I think overall, that our sheep breeders would have been, our stud breeders would have been very happy with the ram selling season, I think. You know, I think when the early sales sort of started in late July, I think everyone was probably still feeling a bit cautious coming out of the drought and sort of not knowing how this season would turn out. Yeah, but I think most studs probably offer a few less rams this year. As you know, sort of breeding ewe numbers are sort of down across the state, and you know, a lot of young ewes were sold off early as lambs processors, and a lot of commercial breeders, they really had to reduce their numbers to limit the cost of buying and fodder. Yeah, you know, the drought, I think the drought of 2024 and the first half of this year certainly had a big impact on everybody's cash flow and their businesses. So, but I think the exceptional sheep and lamb prices that were being achieved certainly helped to put some optimism and confidence into the industry. And as I said, most stud breeders would have been reasonably happy with the results there on property sales. I think overall the clearance rates were pretty good, and sale averages sort of hovered around similar levels to last year, with the odd one being up on the previous year. And you know, averages were generally in the range of $1,500 to $2,000.
I was going to ask Robert, with in terms of just holding on to rams, are there many breeders that held on to rams that will look to then sell them in future sales?
Yeah, I think there probably would be a little bit of a carryover of rams. Yeah, mainly due to, obviously the ewe breeding flock being down across the state, and there's still some areas in the state that are still a bit dry that haven't been fortunate to receive the rains, and, you know, some of the pastoral country is still a bit dry in places. And so there would be a little bit of a carryover of rams heading into next year. Overall, I think the ram selling season was a pretty good result given the tough circumstances leading up to it, I suppose.
I guess that's, you mentioned there about that confidence grew towards the end of the selling season. Was that, you mentioned a few factors there, but I guess that weather and that everyone's sort of keeping an eye on as well, and conditions looking a little bit better heading into next year as well?
Yeah, I think you could see that as we sort of got further into the ram selling season, we saw that lift in the confidence. Yeah, we saw the wool prices started to lift, and and as we sort of got further towards spring there, it's sort of looking like a much more favourable season and a lot more paddock feed available out there, and the prospects of a reasonable harvest probably started to emerge. So, yeah, I think people were certainly feeling a lot more confident going forward. Yeah.
Any record prices or high prices that were surprising this season, Robert?
Yeah, well, I guess if you look at the Adelaide Ram sale, that was a successful sale again. There was a very good crowd in attendance there, and even though there was a few less rams in the sale, the sale average, of 7,560, that was up a couple hundred dollars on last year, and it was very good inquiry from interstate studs as well as SA breeders, and probably no real big prices at the ram sale itself, but there was some pretty impressive private sales with one ram selling privately for $80,000 there in Adelaide, and also during the year there were some pretty impressive private sales as well, with sales up to $50,000 recorded at Bendigo, I think, for some ram sold privately there.
And I guess, speaking to a few people as well, I think the term a lot of people have been using is pleasantly surprised, or a little bit better than what they were expecting. Are you sort of hearing that as well, Robert?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the case. Yeah. As I said, we probably at the start of the ram selling season, we didn't really know what to expect, and I think our stud breeders have got through it pretty well, probably feeling pretty happy with the way the job went, and probably looking forward to next year with probably thinking that demand for rams will probably improve next year, especially if we can get a favourable season. I think commercial breeders are probably going to be looking to rebuild their flocks after the drought, and they can probably certainly see that there'll be some good profit to be made out of a dual purpose merino flock. The dual-purpose merino is probably going to be a very profitable enterprise going forward, I think, with that income stream from both meat and wool. And, there's obviously probably a lot less risk involved with a sheep enterprise, versus a continuous cropping program with the high input costs. So, I think sheep breeders are going to be looking forward with a fair bit of confidence and optimism going into next year.
Just on that confidence side of things, Robert, do you think there'll be more, money being put into things like more breeding programs and that kind of thing moving forward as well?
Yeah, I think as the returns increase, we're certainly going to get some better wool prices going forward. It's going to put a bit more profit back into the sheep breeding industry. So I know our stud breeders in South Australia, they do a great job. They've done a great job improving the carcass traits of their merinos, and they're always trying to improve their genetics. So, any increase in profit, a lot of that profit will go back into improving the genetics of their flocks.
Merino SA President Robert Sullivan speaking with Brooke Neindorf. And sticking with this topic of wool, a new survey from Meat and Livestock Australia and Australian Wool Innovation has revealed a surge in producer confidence across the sheep industry. According to the data, strong market prices are fueling optimism, with many producers planning to rebuild and expand their flocks heading into the new year. Kate Forrester asked head of the domestic operations at Australian Wool Innovation, Scott Carmody, his reaction to the results of the survey.
I'm not so surprised, but very pleased to see producer sentiment improve vastly with what it's done. It's never ever good to see producers thinking negatively about our industry, but to move to a net sentiment of plus 19, up 38 points from last year's sentiment, is great, and that's over twice as many producers have that more positive outlook than a negative one. So those wool prices hitting their three-year highs, the fact that it's rained, these sort of situations are helpful in improving sentiment. So that's what we see as being the driver of this increasing sentiment and positive sentiment in regards to wool production.
So how many producers were involved in this survey, and where have they come from?
It's producers were canvassed from across Australia. There was over 1,800 producers surveyed to obtain this data. There's nationally representative of you know, the data is nationally representative and they'll cover most growing regions of Australia, both in the wool sector, but also the red meat sector. So it does cover a vast across Australia region.
As you just mentioned earlier, nationally, the survey shows that wool sentiment has jumped 38 points to plus 19. How significant is this lift and how does it compare to what we've previously been seeing?
Yeah, it's significant. In a very basic sense, just looking at the data, it shows that wool growers are now positive about wool growing. They're actually turned from being against wool growing and looking at other enterprises, now switching focus back on wool growing as a viable enterprise on farm. So it is significant. And, you know, in particular with WA, with the challenges that have been faced over there, you know, 12% now believe prices will improve and keep improving, whereas that figure was 5% last year. So we're seeing a stronger interest in WA now with a 38-point lift nationally.
Yeah, and a really quick flip in the time scheme of things, I feel.
Yeah. And once again, you know, price obviously influences that. And obviously a good look at enterprises. There was a lot of kickback across Australia last year through climate conditions and other factors that were affecting wool growing, particularly the input costs. And, you know, within our data that we've obtained out of this survey with MLA, it's showing that these input costs are expected to continue. Not many respondents were expecting that pressure on industry to alleviate to any great extent. So we're still seeing those cost pressures. But within that, we're seeing a total sentiment of believing that these wool prices can and do have the ability to improve. And that will focus back onto sheep for wool production, but also in the meat side of things as well.
But so Scott, how sustainable do you think these prices are heading into the new year?
Well, I think with the supply situation, it's commonly known, you know, the shortage of wool in the, not just Australia, but across the world is probably the biggest driver at the moment. But we are seeing that uplift in demand, you know, particularly across the Northern Hemisphere, which was where most of our wool is sold, eventually sold. We're seeing an uptick in demand now. So the improving macroeconomic conditions are going to help wool sales. We are still in that luxury end of the market, that aspirational purchasing market. So we're seeing a slight uptick in there. People are willing to shop again. More of their disposable income is heading towards, you know, clothing rather than just travel and more immediate items that they're wanting to buy and to live off.
Do you think in the past, though, Scott, you've almost in a way, I don't know how to say this any other way, but shot yourself in the foot a little bit trying to target that higher end product with Australian wool?
Yeah, it's really not shooting ourselves in the foot, because really to have wool growers profitable, we need wool to sell at, you know, a luxury or a higher price, a premium price end of the market. If we had wool competing against cotton, for example, or polyester, we're taking $10 to $40 a garment off wool product. And then at that price, we'd be seeing, you know, our processing division of our industry, our spinners, our weavers, they would have to pay half the price to compete against those price levels to supply those goods in store at the price the consumer wanted to pay. So, no, we have to very clearly focus on wool being a premium product. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's an aspirational thing for people, consumers, to aspire to buy wool. And I think it's an aspirational thing to growers to actually produce that luxury fibre.
Do you think this boost in confidence is going forward, influence producer decisions when they're choosing between, you know, a wool-focused and then a meat-focused breed?
I think there's room for everything on farm, and I think the expansion of enterprise that's going to come about because of the improving wool price, you can have a meat component in that industry. Our wool industry has, and our sheep wool, they've always had a meat component. The excess stock, the young wethers getting sold off, that has always been a part of that enterprise on farm. And going forward, the improving wool price, but coupled with that very high meat price at the moment, we've quite often heard in the last couple of months that, you know, people on farm, they've never made so much money out of having, you know, sheep, particularly merino sheep on farm, you know, getting that wool income alongside that very, and we recognise that at the moment, that meat side of the equation is very much leading that. But, you know, you add your fleece values on top of that enterprise and it's becoming very profitable once again.
Well, South Australia in this data is the state that has reported some of the strongest confidence levels across the country. What's driving the optimism in South Australia?
I think it's more about the seasonal conditions in South Australia. I think that's very clear. They've had a couple of very tough years, and you know, the marginal country that a lot of our wool's grown in South Australia, it's, you know, simply wool is grown in a tough environment there, and when it doesn't rain, it becomes almost impossible. So we're seeing that improved growing conditions is absolutely prime thinking that is the cause of that sediment growth. And also that price, they're very aware of the price improvement, and particularly in the type of wool that South Australia produces. South Australia is producing very much that 18.5 through to 21 micron wool. That's the bread and butter of our industry. And they can see those solid prices there that have actually been the most consistent of any prices over the past, not just during these rises, but prior to that, prices were a bit more challenging. I think that's when those growers recognise, if I could grow more, if I can expand, I can make this work. And then you add in that meat component. So the whole enterprise is now turned that profitable corner, and the weather's been very compliant.
Just to finish off with Scott, what does all of this signal for national supply going into 2026, do you think?
Into 26, I think we'll start to see the recovery. I truly believe that, you know, obviously the wool price improving is one factor, but the retaining of that meat value, that meat price too, would be crucial to seeing an uptick in production. And I think 2026 will be the year of consolidation and then growth into our merino sheep, but also our crossbred sheep as well. So we're going to see a sharp uptick in our production levels. I think we can react strongly if the money's there. Our landowners, they will convert some of their land use to growing sheep again.
Scott Carmody there, the head of domestic operations at Australian Wool Innovation. He was speaking with Kate Forrester. And yes, you heard Scott was talking on the wool side of things, but in the sheep meat industry, data revealed producer sentiment towards the sheep meat sector had also jumped up 78%, the highest level since 2022. So certainly some added optimism around in that sector as well. It is 22 minutes past 12.
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
That's one small step for a man.
Right, we'll leave the moon there when we'll go to Randwick for the second leg of the double.
Conversations, this morning from 11 on ABC Radio.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Elsie Adamo with you here today. Now, if you were tuning in yesterday, you would have heard Meat and Livestock Australia held its annual update event in Adelaide. And earlier this week, they announced the winners of the 2025 Meat Standards Australia Excellence in Eating Quality Awards. MLA says the awards highlight dedication and innovation of producers and feedlots who strive for excellence in eating quality. For South Australia, Thomas Foods International took out two awards on the night. General Manager of the TFI feedlot, James Sage, is speaking here with Brooke Neindorf about the wins.
Yeah, we took out the grain-fed category for South Australia and Northern Territory, and to our surprise, we also took out the non-grain-fed category as well. So that was unexpected, but a nice win all the same.
What's the difference between those two? Is there much in what you're doing there? Obviously, you know, grain-fed and non-grain-fed, but what is the difference is there?
Yeah, well, the non-grain-fed category is basically pasture-raised or, you know, in our case, a bit of a mix of natural pasture and some irrigated pivots. So we have, it's a program that we sort of started off early this year with the season that we were having. It hasn't turned out too bad, so we sort of got into that. Some of that has been a sort of a supplementary feed as well on grass and a bit of a grain or pasture fed pellet. So something that, yeah, we kicked off, and we were surprised to win that, but we're very happy to receive that award as well.
When it comes to, obviously, meat standards, it looks at excellence in eating quality. What is it that Thomas Foods really prides itself on when it comes to putting themselves out here for this kind of thing?
Well, I think it's sort of, in the feedlot in particular, it sort of stems back to the Chris and Darren Thomas's vision of building a wonderful facility, sort of state-of-the-art, in a good area with a good climate. And then after that, it sort of comes down to to the whole team in general. We've got a great team of buyers and a great team of producers that supply us quality feeder steers every week, and the buyers have been working with them for many years. That's sort of the start of it. And then beyond that, the facility itself, low stress handling, a fantastic team, you know, putting together a ration each day and looking after the livestock, and everything beyond that, a great admin team, keeping control of quality assurance of all the commodities coming in, a maintenance team, keeping pens clean and bedded throughout the winter. So all of these things go hand in hand to ultimately get a result like we did, particularly in the grain-fed section. So it's a huge team effort, not just one or two people. We like to call it Team TFI. We've all played a big part in trying to get to get that result at the end of the couple of years.
General Manager of the TFI Feedlot, James Sage, speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. It is coming up to 26 minutes past 12. We better get to the weather. Jenny Horvat is our forecaster today from the Weather Bureau. Good afternoon, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Elsie.
Not 2 days of sun in a row here in Mount Gambier. I don't know myself, but how are things looking in the rest of the state?
Yeah, look, not so sunny elsewhere, especially across western parts. We are seeing quite a bit of cloud and even some thunderstorm activity and some showers embedded with that. We've got one of those lows and troughs moving across from the west. So we should start to see some of that high cloud coming into the southeast during the course of the day as this system moves a little bit closer. Rainfall-wise, there hasn't been a lot with this, but we have seen a couple of millimetres in the gauge at Penong and Nullarbor in the 24 hours up until 9 a.m. And so far in the gauge since 9 a.m. again, not too much, 0.8 of a millimetre in the gauge at Ceduna. But we are expecting to see a little bit more as this system continues to move eastwards across the state today. So potentially maybe seeing a little bit of that shower activity moving into the central districts as we head into the evening, but most of the activity today out west could get a little bit windy in parts, and we possibly could see some areas of raised dust, especially in northern parts of the state today, especially the northeast, and maybe again tomorrow. So our trough and low will continue to move eastwards overnight, so across those central districts and into the southeast. So we are expecting to see showers and possible thunderstorms moving more broadly across the state, clearing from the west, as it moves eastwards on Saturday, and clearing the southeast early on Sunday morning. Then it looks like we've got another one of these troughs and low coming in from WA, so possibly coming back into the far west with those showers and thunderstorms on the Sunday, moving more broadly across the state on the Monday, and the chance of some showers and thunderstorms lingering early to mid-week through there. We are seeing temperatures generally across the state looking at above average today in the north and west and below average elsewhere, but we are expecting to see those temperatures on the rise to above average on Saturday and even well above average on Sunday and Monday through there, and we do have a severe heat wave warning currently issued from the northeast pastoral district, but potentially more broadly across the north as we head into early next week with some heat coming in through there. So just having a bit of a look at our rainfall. So cumulative totals until the end of Tuesday. So we're not expecting too much in the far northeast. So generally less than a couple of millimetres there. But as we head further southwards, so across the northern agricultural area and the northwest pastoral district and maybe southern parts of the northeast pastoral district there, we could see those totals getting up around 2 to 5 millimetres. Cumulative, again, over the southern agricultural area, west coast and Flinders district, maybe in the range of 5 to 15 millimetres. And with those thunderstorms possible, maybe some local falls even getting up to around 15 to 30 millimetres. But with those totals, I'm thinking mainly around central and western districts. But we'll see where the positioning of these systems move and where we see those high totals by the end of the weekend and early next week there, Elsie.
Thanks for that, Jenny.
Thank you.
That was Jenny Horvat, our forecaster today from the Weather Bureau. Let's take a look at the Western Inland. In the Upper Western District tomorrow, partly cloudy, slight chance of a shower, chance of a thunderstorm in the afternoon and evening, winds south to southeasterly, 20 to 30 kilometres per hour, tending east to southeasterly in the morning and then southeast to southwesterly in the middle of the day. Overnight temperatures falling to between 16 and 21, with daytime temperatures reaching 33 to 39. And in the lower western district, partly cloudy, medium chance of showers near the South Australian border, slight chance elsewhere, chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the afternoon. Winds southeast to southwesterly, 15 to 20 kilometres per hour, tending northwest to southwesterly in the middle of the day, and then southeast to southwesterly in the evening. Overnight temperatures falling to between 11 and 15, and daytime temperatures reaching between 28 to 34.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Elsie Adamo with you today for The Country Hour, filling in for Selena Green. Thanks for your company so far on the program. And yeah, do stick around. We've got plenty more happening in this next half hour. We're going to be talking wine. In fact, the world's 50 best vineyards for 2025 were announced this week, and only one Australian vineyard made the list. And it's from the Eden Valley. You'll find out more about that in just a moment. Also today, Australian Grape and Wine have a new chair, and they're from the Riverland. And soon you'll hear about beneficial bugs. For a while, integrated pest management has been on the rise in Australia. But how much interest really is there?
When I started, I was very much fringe. I felt very much out in the wilderness. And we almost didn't get through the first 20 years, you know, really didn't. But I must say that I think in the last 5 to 7 years, I think we've almost gone from being, well, fringe to almost becoming mainstream.
Is it something you would consider? Is it something you're already doing on your property? Do let me know. My talkback number today, 1300 160 222, or you can text into the program 0467 922 783. And on the text line has actually been Joe. In the first half of the show, we were discussing increasing optimism in wool. And Joe says, G'day Country Hour. About Merino sheep, the idea that a couple of months of profitable wool prices will entice non-wool growers back into wool sheep is absolute fantasy. It's been too poor for too long. People don't tend to make long-term business decisions for a short-term jump in the market. Yes, Joe, certainly something to keep in mind. I remember back when we were getting those records, a lot of analysts were saying that great in the short term, but it didn't necessarily mean that things had improved in the wool game long term. So certainly a great comment. If you want to have your say again, my talkback number 1300 160 222, or text in 0467 922 783. Now, as I said, lots coming up, but first let's get some news headlines from Sophie Holder. Good afternoon, Sophie.
Good afternoon, Elsie. The Bureau of Meteorology has declared a cyclone warning for Darwin as Tropical Cyclone Fina approaches the Northern Territory coast. Cyclone Fina is currently a Category 1 system, but is expected to increase to Category 2 later today, with a chance it eventually becomes a Category 3. The federal government says it doesn't accept claims it didn't fight hard enough to secure the rights to host COP31. Greens leader Larissa Waters says Australia's failure in its bid to host the Global Climate Conference in Adelaide next year is an embarrassment. Turkey will host, but Australia's climate change minister, Chris Bowen, will be president of negotiations. Minister Amanda Rishworth says the government put its best foot forward and was very clear about its desire to host. And South Australia police are urging South Australians to take steps to protect against parcel theft going into the busy Christmas period. It says suburbs like Mawson Lakes, Morford Vale, Mitchell Park and Prospect have consistently recorded a high number of offences. There'll be more news at 1.
Thanks for that, Sophie. That was Sophie Holder with our headlines. Now, in Australia, we have many brilliant vineyards, but according to the new World's 50 Best Vineyard ranking, only one is good enough to make the cut this year. Announced this week in Western Australia, Henschke Wines Eden Valley Estate was the only Aussie entry on the list, securing the 47th spot. The list is decided by votes from more than 700-strong voting academy, which includes sommeliers, travel and wine tourism experts and wine trade specialists. Stephen Henschke is the fifth-generation chief winemaker and managing director of Henschke Wine. Good afternoon, Stephen. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Thank you very much, Elsie.
Congratulations on being included on this list of the world's best vineyards. How did you feel when you got the news you'd made the cut this year?
We were absolutely elated, somewhat surprised, but absolutely elated and overjoyed that we were included in the top 50 in the world. It's really quite quite amazing, and yeah, it sort of takes your breath away a bit.
Yeah, well, you were the only Australian vineyard to crack the list this year. It's the first time that's happened. What do you think made your vineyard so special?
That's a really interesting question. I guess Henschke probably has somewhat of a reputation now overseas because of, you know, our wines like Hill of Grace and Mount Eddleston. And maybe it's the experiences of people who come to visit us and what have you that's kept us in people's minds when they vote for this sort of competition. But, I mean, to represent Australia was a real honour, and to represent, you know, obviously our region and our family winery was just amazing for us. So, yeah, we're absolutely delighted.
And what's actually involved in making it onto this list? Do you have to submit an application? How does it work?
There's no application. There's no way of having any influence on it. It's purely judged internationally by people who, and we don't even know exactly. I mean, they gave a bit of an explanation of how they do it, but it's really effectively a group of people around the world who, as judges, who then submit their favourite wineries or their favourite vineyards, in this case, around the world. So it was quite interesting to us that there were a lot of South American country wineries now that have appeared on the list in the last year or so. So it obviously goes back to where people travel to and what they enjoy and what really turns them on.
And is it something the business, do you actively think about this during the year? Do you work towards trying to get on this list, or does it just kind of happen?
It just kind of happens. Mm. No, we're really focused on, you know, what our mantra is, being better rather than bigger. We're focusing on environmental values. So Prue, my wife, who's actually with me today, she's been a real pioneer in Australia. Over 30 years ago, she's a botanist, trained botanist, and over 30 years ago, she started to change the way viticulture is done in Australia by using native grasses, native flowering plants, using composts, mulches, biodynamics, organic processes, and what have you. So it's really about the quality of the fruit that makes great wine.
Mm. And it's not the first time you've been included on this list. You made it on between 2020 and 2023, I believe.
That's right.
Does it help? You know, wine is a competitive business. Do these kind of accolades have a tangible benefit for the business? Do you see an increase in visitors?
I think it does have an influence. I mean, we do VIP tours, so we do experiences for people. We started doing this probably 10, 15 years ago now. And people love to do those visits where they can go out and see the Hill of Grace vineyard or the Mount Eddleston vineyard. They can come back and they taste a range of different wines, our top-end wines. And, you know, that's the sort of thing I think has really changed in the wine industry over, certainly in our lifetime, over the last 20 years or so, where people are much more engaged. Rather than just being, you know, Brown's cows turning up at the winery, they want to have an experience. They want to taste a range of wines. They want to sit down, hear the stories, and, you know, see the winery, see the vineyards, and actually get a good understanding of what's happening. And I think that's a really positive thing because it really improves the culture. I mean, wine is a cultural part of our lives. It goes back, you know, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years. So to be able to give people those experiences is really what has been successful for us and has probably helped us get to that list, and I'm sure does encourage other people to come to Australia.
So before I looked through the list, I was expecting, you know, old wine locations to dominate, you know, lots of France, lots of Spain, and they are certainly represented. But as you mentioned, Stephen, lots of entries from other places as well, like Chile, Uruguay, South Africa, Argentina, even Japan. Your family's been doing this work for a long time. Have you noticed a change or, you know, opening up of the wine industry into these new world wines that, you know, they start to get this prestige now and are getting that recognition?
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. I mean, we're a five-generation old family winery now. We're into the sixth generation. And obviously wine is changing enormously, and people are going to other places like, as you mentioned, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, to plant vineyards and make wine. You know, I think Australia still has huge potential. I mean, probably one of our successes is the fact that we have a lot of our wines on wine lists in the UK, in Germany, and, you know, different countries like that, which is a real positive to get people to be aware. But there's still a lot more opportunity for awareness of the great wines of Australia. And one of the things that we have done with a number of the older family-owned wineries in Australia, like the Tyrrells, the Brown Brothers, and people like that, was to form what we call Australia's First Families of Wine. And Australia's First Families of Wine is the old family wineries, which have a wine, you know, a top-end wine on the Langdon's classification. We have old vineyards, historical vineyards. So we have the whole range of things that are quite unique to these wineries. And we're promoting, I guess, if you like, the top. We're promoting to the top, so the best wines in Australia. Where, you know, I think as a group of wineries, we've seen that too much of the Australian commercial wines is seen overseas, and Australia doesn't get the recognition of having probably some of the best wines in the world. But we, you know, by forming a group together, we have the opportunity of promoting now together the best wines of Australia. And that's from, you know, the families who have, you know, real skin in the game for generations and generations, and have the future, because the next generation is so enthusiastic, you know, like our daughter and our sons, just so enthusiastic about the wine industry, you know, the vineyards, the quality, and those relationships with people.
And will you be holding a bit of a celebration for the winery and the workers now that you've officially made the list for 2025?
I think a toast is due, yes.
Crack open a good bottle at least.
Absolutely.
Well, congratulations again to you, Stephen, and to Prue and the whole Henschke team. It's quite an achievement.
Thank you. Obviously, really appreciate it. Yeah, we're overjoyed. It's just a great, great experience and a great opportunity and a great accolade. So, yeah, we're very proud.
That was Stephen Henschke, Chief Winemaker and Managing Director of Henschke Wines, joining us. Now, staying in the Eden Valley just a little bit longer, late September is usually the end of the danger period for frosts, and growers this time of year would usually be bracing for storm season. But several regions have experienced late season frosts last week, including Eden Valley, Clare Valley, and parts of the Barossa Valley. Andrew Holt, who runs Poonawatta Wines in the Eden Valley, says 80 to 90% of their old vines dating back to the 1800s were hit by frost.
We've got a frost fan. We saw the temperature was forecast for 3 degrees, so we knew it was going to be a chance of a frost. And the frost fans kicked off at 12:30 a.m. last Wednesday morning, Wednesday week ago, and they continued to run right through till sunrise. I went up to the vineyard in the early hours and just checked that the air was moving nicely, and at that point it was still just above zero. But typically with these frosts, the coldest air comes in around an hour or so before sunrise, and that's when the temperatures dropped to, I think it was close to -3, but it was the depth of cold air that was the real problem, that the frost fans just weren't able to pull any warmer air in to mix things up and raise the temperature at ground level and at canopy height level, and that's where the damage occurred.
I'm so sorry to hear that. It's so frustrating because, of course, you know, you get told, have your frost fans, but you can't do much if, you know, they're no match for the frost.
That's the challenge, I guess, is that Mother Nature will throw things at us, and we can do certain things to mitigate the risk, but not every solution is going to be the right fit every time. We used to run sprinklers in the particular vineyard that is most frost prone, which is our old vines planted back in 1880. So that's our highest value crop. And the sprinklers work tremendously well up until about early November, when they can effectively cover the canopy once the vines sort of grow to enough of a degree that there's too much leaf area to cover. The sprinklers are less effective. But the sprinklers also work really well when you've got water in your dam. And we've had a really dry run for the last decade or so with below average rainfalls, where the dams have only filled twice in the last 10 years. So that's been effectively our sprinkler system has been decommissioned because we haven't had the water to run it. So that's why we've then moved to frost fans. And again, they work well if there is warmer air that they can pull in to mix up with the colder air. But if the sub-zero air is above the top of the frost fan, then we're in trouble.
And have you ever had such a late frost event?
We have had later frost events in the past. I think it was back in 2016. It was literally 2 days after the Pinery bushfires, and it was right at the end of November. It might have even been beginning of December, and it was a 35-degree forecast day, but the temperature dipped down to the minuses probably about half an hour before sunrise, and that did a bit of damage. So certainly late frost can occur, but they're not typical. It tends to be in that sort of mid-September through to late October period when we see the greatest, I guess, risk of a frost incident.
And what's the damage been like at your place?
It's been mixed. The old vines were the hardest hit. I would think we're looking at somewhere around 80-90%+ damage. We've already gone in and reworked most of that vineyard. We've got another Shiraz block that's a 40-year-old block that was hit pretty hard as well. Bushvine Grenache block that was hit quite hard. Bushvine's been close to the ground. And our Riesling vineyard, which is 50 years old, has always been in an area that is frost-free. But it was hit for the first time in the severe frost that went through in September of last year. And that really decimated a lot of vineyards through the Eden Valley, Barossa Valley and Clare Valley region. And it was hit again this year, and I would say losses of somewhere around about 40% in the Riesling block. So quite unusual for a vineyard that's never been frost affected before to be hit 2 years in a row.
Poonawatta Wines, Andrew Holt speaking with Eliza Bellage.
The Country Hour. Celebrating 80 years.
Understanding how they grow best.
The Country Hour.
Nourishing the people in their own community.
Part of your community for 80 years.
It's highly regarded.
Weekdays at noon.
Go straight to the source.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
Elsie Adamo with you here today. It is 13 minutes to one. Now, 20 years ago, using insects to control pests was seen as a fringe idea. Now it's a growing part of an integrated pest management in Australia. But as more farmers adopt the approach, are there risks they might not be seeing? Landline's Helena Benikowski spoke with Bailey Pullman at Gatton Nursery, and he reckons bugs are a huge bugbear.
Probably the biggest one would be Western flower thrips or thrips. Selling ornamental plants, they'll actually scratch at the new growth, and that will distort that new growth. So it's very like visually obvious that there's been a pest damage to that plant.
They're treating the issue through IPM, or Integrated Pest Management, using a combination of beneficial bugs along with other methods.
We wanted to get away from chemicals. We wanted to reduce our environmental footprint and just try to, incorporate these bugs into our system.
Integrated pest management isn't new. The idea was introduced in the late 1990s, but it's gained traction in the past 10 to 15 years. Melina Miles is an entomologist working for the Queensland Department of Primary Industries. She researches developing strategies for growers to manage pests better.
We look at all the components as best we can. So, you know, rather than focusing just on probably the most effective control that growers have available to them, which is insecticides, we also look at natural enemies, the impact of the insecticides on the natural enemies.
Landline last caught up with Melina in 2023, fighting the incursion from the devastating fall armyworm.
We knew immediately, and the growers knew immediately, the risks that fall armyworm brought in terms of overuse of insecticide, because if we relied just on insecticide, you know, we were on a really slippery slope, and insecticide resistance is widespread overseas.
Dan Papacek is one of the founders of Bugs for Bugs, a company that grows and provides insects for IPM.
When I started, I was very much fringe. I felt very much out in the wilderness. In fact, we got a lot of critical comment, and we almost didn't get through the first 20 years, really didn't. But I must say that I think in the last 5 to 7 years, I think we've almost gone from being, fringe to almost becoming mainstream. You've got no idea how many sort of conventional growers now are adopting the sort of principles that we endorse.
The orders come in thick and fast, with Dan and his team coming up with fit-for-purpose packaging. The next step is all about timing, ensuring the insects arrive in peak condition for release.
We supply them as eggs en route, on their way to their destination. Those eggs will hatch or soon after arrival, and then growers will release them as the early instar larval stage of the lace wing.
So timing must be real.
Timing is really critical with a lot of the work we do. Yeah, just getting these things to the grower or the consumer at the right timing in their development for them to sort of apply them to their crop or their plants or whatever. Yeah.
The bugs can end up as far away as Lakelands, west of Cooktown in far north Queensland. Here, farming family, the Indibitsons, use the beneficials on their bananas. Across two different family farms, there's a range of methods for spreading the bugs. On Paul's banana farm, there's the good old-fashioned arbor tree and sprinkle. And then down the road, cousin Andrew uses the high-tech drone version on the family's avocado farm. Paul Indibitson is practical about the benefits of using these bugs.
You'll never get complete control of it, but it's just adding a few more beneficials into the system to level the playing field a little bit. It means we don't have to consider any more insecticides or any insecticides. So, yeah, we don't get on a continuous regime of just spraying and spraying and spraying.
Melina Miles reckons farmers like this are leading the way, but acknowledges the use of IPM can be a hard sell for some of the large broad acre farms.
It takes a lot of effort to be checking and monitoring. For some growers, that's not possible. The more remote you are, the less likely it is you're going to have those resources. So I think it's really important that we think about not IPM as one thing that everybody does, but the principles applied in the context that you operate in and the crops that you grow and, the industries that you're in.
When it comes to what's actually crawling through the crops, the list of problem pests is long and growing.
What are the main issue bugs that you're trying to combat?
Oh, out there in the field. Look, it's a very wide range, but things like thrips, mealybugs, scale insects, whiteflies, aphids, all these things come to mind very readily. A lot of mite issues, things like spider mites and broad mites and rust mites and things like that as well. And we certainly don't have a biological solution for every pest problem, I think.
Entomologist Dan Pepacek finishing that story by Helena Baxkowski. And you can watch the full version on Landline this Sunday or anytime on ABC iView. Now, finally today, levy reform and uniting the industry will be the key focuses for the new chair of Australia Grape and Wine. Helen Strawn is the first female chair, and she grew up on a stone fruit and wine grape block in South Australia's Riverland. Eliza Berlage spoke to her about taking on this leadership role amid the global wine crisis.
So I had a few people sort of call me or message me saying, please apply for it. And I was actually hesitating at that point in time because I'd gone through a really significant process in terms of managing Pernod Ricard winemaker sale, and I knew that I was actually pretty exhausted. And so I wasn't 100% certain that I would be the exact right person for the chair, but a few people reached out to me, and I think there's a few reasons for that. One of them is that I have been a long-standing board member, and I'm reasonably trusted, I think, by a lot of other board members. So definitely a few people, I guess, tapped me on the shoulder to apply. That was good. In terms of mentors, yes, I think probably the person that comes to mind was the previous chair of Australian Grape and Wine, Sandy Clark. He's always been someone that's, I think supported me. I've been able to touch base with him from time to time, and he was, definitely hopeful that I would also get this role as well. So I would probably put him in that category. I've actually been, honestly, extremely fortunate in my career that I've had a lot of good people around me that have supported me, and, they're always there to to call or to have a conversation with if I'm considering, you know, something like this. So I've actually been really fortunate in that regard.
To keep working in the industry, you must be either an eternal optimist or see some good opportunities.
Yeah, look, I probably am. I think maybe I am an eternal optimist. But look, I actually love the industry. So I think a lot of people love the industry. We get to, grow an agricultural product and produce a product that actually people, genuinely enjoy. And there's a lot of really good people in the industry. So, and it also brings a lot of tourism into South Australia and places like the Riverland. There's a lot of, benefit and advantages, to the industry. In terms of, future opportunities, I'm going to be sort of focused on trying to, my desire is to work towards getting a sort of an industry-owned corporation. So you have Australian Grape and Wine, which is what I'm chair of, and then there's Wine Australia, which is the statutory bodies responsible for marketing and exporting, and it receives the levies. I think that there's a lot of opportunity, and I'm not alone in my thinking here, to bring those organisations together. We do need the federal government support for that. So there's a lot of, work that still needs to be done to achieve that, but I think it actually achieves a few things, and one of them is to make bring one organisation together. So there's complete transparency on levy spend. We want to make sure that it's the industry, leading the industry's requirements, so that people that are sitting in the Riverland can say, yes, actually my levy spend is being spent on X, Y, and Z, and that's exactly, what it should be. They won't necessarily always agree with other people who also want the levy to be spent in different ways. And, I think that we can't expect everyone to be, fully in agreement at all times. But there is, opportunity to make the organisations that, run this industry more streamlined, more transparent, and that's what I want to be involved in. So I think there's opportunity on the structural side, and essentially I guess my view is that the status quo for the industry and for the industry bodies is actually it's no longer viable. It's not working at the moment, so we need to look at how we can change that. There's also potential of changing, looking to change the levies, because, maybe what was appropriate and fair and reasonable a number of years ago is no longer the case. So again, we need to work through all of that. So in terms of, future opportunities, I guess I would love to think that, the vast majority of growers, in places like the Riverland still have a role, a business, a future, but we also need to, make sure that we're fully understanding that there is an oversupply and demand is decreasing. So there are going to be some businesses that, probably shouldn't be necessarily growing grapes into the future, and that would include in places like the Riverland. And I think, we all have to sort of understand and recognise that as well.
You grew up in the Riverland. Where do you see that influencing the person you've become and what you can do in this role?
I think it's had a really significant impact. I mean, I think wherever you grow up and the family that you grow up in and the environment that you grow up in, really does shape you for, your future life. So, I was born in Renmark. I grew up in Renmark. I was number four of five children in my family. And my father was a grape and fruit grower from Renmark, and my mother was a long-standing school teacher and librarian at Renmark High School. And so, I had a quintessential Renmark upbringing in the sense that we grew up on a fruit block. We all worked very hard on the fruit block. I also got to see what being in agriculture can mean in terms of, the good and the bad. So, it can lead to a, quite a good lifestyle, but it also, I was there at times when, storms would come through at the end of November and you knew that the first apricot crop would be completely wiped out, and just sort of seeing the effect on your parents' faces when they knew that, there was actually very limited income coming through for that period of time. And from the perspective of this role, I think it probably does lend itself to something that, not everyone necessarily has, which is, I do understand what it's like to be the daughter of growers and how tough that can be. So, I think I do bring that perspective to this role. it doesn't mean that that's the only perspective that I need to have for this role, because there's a lot of other things that have shaped me, and also there are a lot of other factors that we need to consider as an industry. But, you know, I think it's been really important in terms of, you know, me growing up in Renmark and what that's brought to me for this role.
Incoming Chair of Australian Grape and Wine, Helen Strawn, speaking with Eliza Berlage. Now that's all we have time for the Country Hour today and for this week. Thank you so much for your company, especially today, choosing us over the cricket. I do appreciate it. The Rural Team will be back on Monday. Before then, though, you can always head online anytime, abc.net.au/rural, to read more of what our journalists have been up to in the Rural Team this week. I'm Elsie Adamo. It's coming up to your 1 o'clock news headlines.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.